Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Hi, everyone. This is Phelan Oliver, and I'm back with you for a book review. You are used to hearing me on the Women We Failed mini-series or the Call to Fight mini-series with the math guru, Vanessa. But this month, we're taking a little break on that, and I'm going to bring you a positive book review. Now, if you heard my intro, I told you that I am totally into self-help books and I love recommendations. This month, I'm going to recommend the book The Gratitude Jar by Josie Robinson. The story is about Josie herself and her spiritual transformation and her self-discovery and how she used a nightly ritual to change her entire life. She talks about how she was abusing substances and not being a very good parent, and she really was miserable and wanted to change things around. Someone had suggested to her to practice the gratitude jar method, which is every night saying something that you're grateful for, writing it down, and putting it into a jar. She practiced it with her son every single night. And the transformation of who she becomes as a person, even just during that short span of time that she was doing that, is just an incredible thing to read. And it inspired me to start practicing the gratitude jar method with my daughter. So we practice the nightly ritual every night for 30 days. And after the 30-day mark, I wanted to keep going. It really helped me look at things differently. I was going through a really tough time in my life when I did this initially, and I wasn't sure what was up and what was down. I was pretty depressed and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my career. And I saw myself in a miserable place as well and decided, why not? Like, what am I going to lose by practicing this? So every single night, me and my daughter, we would sit down and think about something that we were grateful for throughout the day. And having that moment to think at night about what I was grateful for throughout the day really pushed me during the day to try to find things to be grateful for, which then allowed me to practice more gratitude, which also helped me change my life even more. I definitely recommend picking up this book and reading it. You might have to order it. I've always had to order it or ask them to order it. I read this book initially in 2018, and I've given it away to so many people as gifts. I always come back to it when I'm feeling down because it is just like a pick-me-up book. It's only 120 pages. It's such a short read, so I feel like if I say too much, it'll give way too much away. But I read it in less than a day because it was just so good. I couldn't put it down, and it just really gave me a jolt of motivation to try to, you know, transform my own life. And it really did. Like, I still practice the gratitude jar method. And if you're interested in seeing like how I do it or how I've decorated my gratitude jar, I will post in my Instagram stories on Friday morning. And I'll talk a little bit more about my gratitude jar and the gratitude jar method. But again, this book is The Gratitude Jar by Josie Robinson. It is just like a soul warming book. And it's such a short read. And if you're in a funk or if you just want like something that feels really good, I recommend picking up this book and reading it. Okay, so if you'd like to follow me on Instagram, my Instagram handle is Phelan Oliver. It's PhalinOliver. And thank you so much for tuning in with me today. Looking forward to next time. Have a fantastic week.
Today's episode is sponsored by Podcorn. Podcorn is a marketplace connecting podcasters to amazing podcast sponsorship opportunities, such as host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. Podcasters of all size can browse and choose opportunities right on the platform, set their own rates, and collaborate with brands directly without any exclusivities. You never have to give up any rights to your podcast, and Podcorn is here to support you at every step and ensure you're protected and compensated for the work that you do for brands. The marketplace mission is to give podcasters transparency, creative freedom, and full control of how and when we monetize. So, head to podcorn.com or click the link in our show notes to sign up and start browsing sponsorship opportunities. Thanks to Podcorn for sponsoring today's episode. Hi everyone, Renee Powers here. Today I am chatting with Danielle Henderson. Danielle is a TV writer whose credits include Maniac, Divorce, and Difficult People. A retired freelance writer and former editor for Rookie, she's been published by The New York Times, The Guardian, Afar Magazine, BuzzFeed, and The Cut. A book based on her popular website, Feminist Ryan Gosling, was released in 2012. Danielle currently co-hosts the podcast, I Saw What You Did There, with Millie DeChirico, about the weird ways we respond to and learn to love movies. She likes to watch old episodes of Doctor Who when she is on deadline. One of her tattoos is based on the movie Rocky, and she will never stop using the Oxford comma. This is probably the best bio I've ever read. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to personally thank you for Feminist Ryan Gosling. I was in my last couple years of college and into my master's program. And it was one of those things that we were, you know, in gender studies classes and just passing it around weekly. It was
so happy. Yeah, it was born out of my own dissatisfaction, I guess you could say, with my academic life. I went to do my master's degree right after my undergrad. I went back to college when I was 30. So when I got to my master's degree program, and my major was gender studies, I found the theory so heavy. And it's not fun. Shouldn't this be a little bit interesting and fun? And I made it fun for myself by putting feminist text over Ryan Gosling's face.
So good. But that's actually another thing we have in common. I was reading your bio or acknowledgments at the end of the book, and you are a fellow PH dropout. That's what I call myself. I don't know about you. Yeah,
I call myself an escapee.
Yeah. Oh, perfect. Yeah. I spent 6 years in it and I was like, what am I doing with my life? What was your impetus for leaving?
I did my PhD. I started my PhD in communications and media. And I really
same.
See? Okay. This explains a lot for us. Yes. I wanted to teach and I wanted to kind of get the full experience of it. But then I started my PhD program and I was just so disenchanted. And my professors were so cruel and they were so not. I was used to the collaborative community experience of academia, and that was not happening. And then I kind of looked around the room and I realized I'm going to be talking to the same six people for the rest of my life. And I would not want to talk to the same six people for the rest of my life in any capacity. I also saw the writing on the wall that they are graduating more people than they will ever employ. So even if I got a PhD, I could end up teaching in the middle of, you know, nowhere, Iowa, and maybe that was great, maybe it wouldn't, but I wouldn't necessarily have a choice. And so it felt limiting. Ultimately, the answer is that academia started to feel more limiting than it did freeing. And I felt like, you know, I can teach with a master's degree if that's still what I want to do, but I just wanted my life to be fuller. And I always thought that academia was going to be something that gave me that freedom. And it became very clear to me that it was not going to.
Yes, that is everything that I felt as well. So let's talk about your new memoir, The Ugly Cry. It is absolutely fantastic. Can you give our audience your kind of elevator pitch for those who haven't read it yet?
Yeah, this is a book about my life from up to age 18. And it's about my life with my single mother and brother early on. We lived with my grandparents. And then a turn of events happens where there's a lot of abuse and drugs come into the picture. And by the time I'm 10 years old, I end up living with my grandmother for the rest of my school experience. I didn't live with my mom ever again. So it's kind of about, you know, it's very funny. It's very tender. It's definitely a tearjerker, I've heard. Mm-hmm. But it is, it's really just about everything that comes with the, what family could look like and what family actually does look like, and all of the joy and the trauma that comes with it.
It is one of the funniest memoirs I've ever read. And I wasn't expecting that going into it. I think maybe it was pitched as like, it's a funny feel good memoir. And I was like, okay, try me, like come at me with your humor. And you did.
Thank you. That's good to hear.
It was laugh out loud funny. Oh,
that's so great. And a lot of people really do. Like, I've read some interviews and I'm like, did they actually like get the comedy at all? Because they're like, this is a heavy book about abuse. And I'm like, it's not just that. It is in there, but it's not just that. So I always appreciate it when people understand that there is also humor involved.
Absolutely. And is that, maybe I'm projecting here, but do you think that your sense of humor comes from the childhood trauma that you experienced? Is that a coping mechanism? Is that how you make sense of it? Talk to me about where your humor comes from.
It really does. I think it primarily comes from my grandmother, first and foremost. She is, to say she is non-traditional is an understatement. And she is someone who 100% laughed at more than she was angry or upset or cried about. And she used humor as a way to, I think, kind of point out her, you know, the challenges in her life and some of the difficulties of life. And I think if she didn't laugh through it, she would have been a very different person. So it comes from her and watching that in action. But I also think that there's just a lot that can be funny about, you know, difficulties. And, you know, I don't make fun of my abuse. You know, that wasn't funny at all. But I think that, you know, as someone who's always paid attention to people, the way people respond or react or the things they say are always kind of funny to me. Like, it's just kind of an interesting way to observe people. And I've had to learn in my own life, you know, through therapy, of course, like most of us, humor can definitely be a deflection. And, you know, I my current therapist, when I started working with her a few years ago, in our first meeting, she said, you know, you use humor to deflect your emotions. And I kind of looked at her, I was like, ha, ha, ha. And then I started crying. And I'm like, okay, she's a witch. Like, this is going to be interesting because she is clearly a witch. So I understand that it is a part of the process of healing. And it's also can be a deflection. But I think it's very important to notice the humorous aspects of life because it helps you get through.
Yeah. And it helps you, I've found in lots of therapy. Also, I always felt like I got an A+ in therapy when I made my therapist laugh.
Right.
So some are harder than others.
It's a good feeling.
But I find that humor is a way of kind of readjusting the past to a way that feels like you have agency over it. Like, yes, I can laugh about it now. It means that maybe I'm not totally healed from it, but at least I can see it in a different way as opposed to like how bad it hurt at the time.
That's an excellent point, and it's very true. It's that you can only have humor about things in hindsight that were very difficult. And I think you're right. It's a way of readjusting, and it's a way of also kind of sustaining. Like it's a very it's a survival technique in a lot of ways in both instances. So you're laughing to survive in the moment, but you're also, you know, possibly using humor to survive the healing.
So yes, this is a funny memoir. Yes, we see, you know, you're growing up in a very unstable situation with your mother and her boyfriend who is doing drugs in the home and beating his son and visiting you in the night. Yes, that shit's heavy. Ultimately, though, I think when I finished the book, it ends on a beautiful note of appreciation for your grandmother. And I think what it is, what is this, 300-some pages? A 300-something page love letter to your grandmother.
Yeah.
How has she shaped you and how does she continue to shape you?
Well, she's always been my... It's kind of strange to say this about your grandmother, but she's always been my biggest fan and my fiercest competitor. Like, she is someone who is always in support of me, but when she's not, when we're butting heads, we are really butting heads about something. So she taught me how to fight in so many ways. And she taught me how to fight. So, you know, for example, she taught me how to fight for myself and my own independence. She taught me how to physically fight. She taught me, you know, how to fight for my beliefs and how to fight for the people I love and fight for my friendships. So there's a lot that's encapsulated in that. And that's why I say, you know, she's a fierce competitor, because she's always been who she is. And she shaped me in so many ways by just being who she is. And so showing me the importance of using your voice and the importance of being yourself at a very young age, where I know people now, I'm going to be 44 next week. I know people now who don't know who they are. And it's not because they're searching for something new. It's because they've never taken that time to figure out who they are. So I feel like, you know, it made me fearless in a way to grow up with somebody like her, because I knew that I was never going to meet anyone who was that challenging or that mean or mm-hmm. that funny. So it made me, I think the biggest gift that she's given me is fearlessness. And it allowed me to go out in the world and just say yes to things and to try different things. So, you know, I've lived in so many different places, and it's because I just said, yeah, sure, I'll try it. What's the worst that can happen? And that comes from her. So she continues to shape me in that. I'm very lucky to have my grandmother at this age. Most people don't have their grandparents in their life in their 40s. And, she's 88, and I just moved back to my hometown and bought a house because I want her to live with me. She's getting to a point where, you know, she's got Alzheimer's and she's not going to be able to live by herself forever. And she told me, she's always told me that she never wants to be in a home. And so I was the only person in my family who could kind of make this shift. And I did it for her because I want her, I want to give her what she's given me, which is this real comfort and care. And, that kind of, she's kind of the only person I feel like I've ever had unconditional love with. And so it just reminds me now that I'm looking at it in this moment that she taught me how to love people. And so she's really shaped my concept of what it means to be a generous and emotionally generous person. And so I'm happy to do it, So she's great. And she's still at 88. Cursing and watching horror movies, and again, still completely herself. So I get to see, I feel very lucky because I get to see in her that the notion of growing older has never been scary to me. And the notion of being, aging has never been scary to me. I think there are things I need to do to make sure I take care of myself since I don't have or want kids, but I'm not afraid of getting older because I've seen her get older and she's just been fantastic.
As someone who watched two grandparents and an uncle pass away from complications of Alzheimer's, I am so sorry to hear about that diagnosis. And I'm so glad that she has someone like you to be there for her when things.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'm sorry to hear that for you as well. And it's not lost on me that this is not going to be like a fun, easy Golden Girls kind of living experience. Like, it's going to be hard. And Alzheimer's is tough. And she gets scared a lot because she doesn't know what's happening to her. So I think it's going to be a new challenge, but there aren't a lot of ways in my life that I've been able to exhibit this kind of love and care. So I'm kind of happy to do it.
Yeah. Your book only goes up to truly the moment that you move out of your grandmother's house when you're 18 years old on your way to college. Why only write up to this point? Why cover your childhood?
I think that so much had happened to me up to that point that it felt like a full story. It felt like this is, when I was writing the book, I tried to think about, where I was going to start. And then as I started writing, I realized, well, if I don't go back a little bit further, then this won't make any sense. And if I don't go back a little bit further than that, then this won't make sense. So I kind of really had to start at the beginning, like a super villain. I started with my birth, So it felt like a full story. Like, those 18 years of my life were very complicated. And everything that happened after that were things that I chose. And so it felt like this was a story about me surviving things and people and places, and what comes next is, you know, the life that I've chosen to make for myself. So it felt like a different story to tell.
One of my favorite moments is, I think you're in a gas station or a bookstore or something where you discover Sassy magazine for the first time.
Yeah.
I have a very similar, you know, come to Jesus moment like that, where like, oh, media for girls and women doesn't have to be just Cosmo. And it struck me because I know that you were an editor for Rookie for some time too. And I know that for, you know, younger millennials, older Gen Z, Rookie Mag was such a moment. Do you think, maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, maybe I'm putting too many things together here, but do you think that discovering Sassy magazine ultimately led you or influenced your time at Rookie?
Oh, completely. I think that it's, you know, and it wasn't linear, like it wasn't like a direct line, but absolutely, because with Sassy magazine, I was able to see people taking teenage girls seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was very important to Rookie, and it was very important to me, you know, that we not perpetuate this idea that teenage girls are frivolous and, you know, not intelligent and not in control of their emotions and not in control of their lives. So my time at Rookie, it was so thrilling because I got to be part of the process of creating that instead of just reading about it. And, you know, I don't know if you remember, but at the time that Rookie came out, there wasn't really a lot of that for teenage girls.
Right.
We're on the end of that like Pussycat Dolls sort of era. And so, you know, the way things are cyclical, it needed to come back. Same thing as, you know, the Sassy magazine was a product of, you know, a little bit was at least a product of, you know, the backlash for surviving the 80s and all of the like heavy metal and, you know, sexualized women and things that we were seeing in the 80s. And so I was thrilled to be part of that process. And I absolutely loved my time there. And I'm still so close to so many of the writers and to Tavi. And it was just, it was a real community experience that helped to remind me of the importance of giving back constantly, even just by telling what your story is and inspiring people and being inspired by people. I'm so inspired by young women that have so much of a better hold on what they, you know, what their lives could be and what they want and kind of that fierceness and that independence than we had at that age. So yeah, it was definitely related.
I mean, can you imagine having Rookie? I mean, you had Sassy. I had girl.com. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Yeah. GURL.com. That was my kind of go-to media source as a preteen. But can you imagine having those kinds of things really early on in your life and how that could shape you? I lived in the same neighborhood as Tavi Jevonson for, you know, when she was in high school, and she was just a force. Like, to have someone like that creating something incredible like Rookie is so monumental for preteen girls.
Oh, completely. If I had had that earlier on, I would be like an intergalactic ruler at this
point. For sure.
The fact that I'm who I am is great, but I would have been 90 times more powerful as a kid.
Well, that moment was one of my favorite moments of the book, and I would love to hear what some of your favorite moments to write and revisit were.
It was really fun to write about my first fight with my friend Angela, because it impacted me so heavily. When we were playing kickball in my backyard, my friend Angela was kind of changing the rules, and I just stormed the mound and punched her. And then I ran into my house and cried, because I gave her a bloody nose and it was terrifying. So it just really very quickly made me realize I don't want physical violence to be part of my life at all. But it was really fun to write that, because it really is about, you know, my brother and his friends, and kind of reminded me of some of the funnier aspects of my youth. And I really loved writing about my time working in the toy store and getting to babysit for a coworker, Helen, and getting to experience her family. So she's still my friend. She and her kids, who are now in their 20s and 30s, are still very, very much a part of my life. And I just feel like that was a turning point moment for me, because it was the first time that an adult took me seriously and it, you know, treated me like I was someone who had something to say and made me feel like I was part of something. So it was just, you know, things like that were always great to write. I was surprised and happy to write any moment where I could find some grace with my mom, particularly that that chapter where I write about watching her get ready to go out, because she was always such a mystery to me. And, you know, again, like, she's like this physically beautiful person who I really wanted her attention all the time. And so watching her was somehow sometimes the only way I could get close to her. And I liked writing about that because it reminded me of some of that grace. And it reminded me that my entire childhood wasn't all bad. So I couldn't really write about my childhood as being completely terrible because I had moments.
Hmm. Yeah, I can imagine that could be really healing as well. I also imagine that was then unpacked in therapy.
Completely. I mean, I reached a point a couple of years ago in therapy where I thought, like, I'm almost done with therapy. Like, I'm so healthy. And then I finished this book and I was like, I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life.
It is a never-ending process. So why this book now then? Why do you think that you've come to a certain kind of understanding that you could work on this? Or what made you start this book now?
I kind of felt like I reached a point where I had enough hindsight to write about this life that I've lived in a way that wasn't purely based on reactive emotions. And that was important to me, like, to kind of treat it as a full story for me meant not just digging into that one emotion I was feeling at the time. So that was part of it, is that I felt like I had enough emotional growth to really look at my life. But also, I feel like, you know, in my mid-40s, that's a good time to look back at where I've come from, because my life has changed so much. And I have really not lived a linear life. And so when people ask me things like, well, how did you get into TV writing, or how did you do this? I don't have an answer. And so now I can give them a book and just say, this is how it began. Mm-hmm. You know, this is why I am the way I am. And maybe this can help. So it was really a way for me to synthesize my own life. And I think that I needed that, because I was at a point when I started writing this book of extreme evolution in my own life. And I wanted to examine where that came from and everything I've been.
And then what do you want readers to take away from it?
I want people to really see it as a full product. So I want them to laugh and cry. But more than anything, I just want people to recognize that the notion and concept of family is so varied and so wide and means so many different things to so many different people. And that, you know, you can put your life on the page and hope that it resonates. But more than anything, I just want people to know that they're not alone. And I don't know that this book would have been helpful to me as a teenager, because I don't know what kind of person I would have turned into with any outside influences that I didn't already have. But I do think it would have been an important book for me to read about in my 20s or 30s, and to see that there are families like mine where you're not raised by a mother and father. And for various reasons, a lot of people are not raised by their primary parents. And that, you know, that it doesn't have to be a life sentence that condemns you to always feeling like an outsider. So I kind of just want people to realize that, you know, that their origin story, or at least my origin story, is not something that defined me. It impacted me, but it didn't define me.
It's truly a beautiful book. I am such a voracious reader of memoir, but it's taken me a while to get back into memoir after, you know, the events of the last year. And so if, you know, our audience out there is feeling the same way, this is an excellent, beautiful, funny, fast-paced book that you can step your toe back into your memoir reading, if that's what you're looking for. So thank you as a reader for this book now. It's covering your life growing up, but it felt really current and relatable. I just loved it. So
thank you. Thank you so much, truly.
Where can we find you online if we want to keep up with what's next and what you're doing now?
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, I co-host a podcast called I Saw What You Did. It's on the Exactly Right Network. We have weekly episodes. That's always a great way to catch up with me. And you can also check my website, daniellehenderson.net. And I'm on Instagram. I use Instagram more regularly than any other social media program. And it's just my name, Danielle Henderson.
We will leave links to all of that in the show notes. I have been forgetting to ask some of our guests, so I'm not going to do it this time. Do you have a book recommendation for our audience that's not one of your own?
Yes, there is a book that came out recently called Rainbow Milk by Paul Mendez, and it's beautiful, and I think everyone should read it.
Okay, we will put that in the show notes. Go out and get The Ugly Cry, a memoir by Danielle Henderson. You won't be disappointed. You can find me on Instagram at Belle Renee or Feminist Book Club at Feminist Book Club Box. And be sure to check out the show notes to links to everything. And Danielle, thank you so much again for spending time with me today, for writing this book, and for just being you, your force in the universe. And thanks to your grandmother for raising such a badass woman.
Thank you so much. She would love to hear that. I'll tell her you said so.
Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.